Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. When you study history, a lot of it is studying not just the names and the places, but the wars, and a lot of those names and places are connected to wars. We've got the big wars of our century and the centuries before. We usually mark a lot of, we kind of punctuate American history by talking about its history of warfare, and no other history is any different than that. Even the history of the Reformation, the 16th century Christian Reformation. And there were several wars that were waged in the course of that. One of them began on this day in 1546, the so-called Small Caldic War. And I dare say if you're not a student of Christian history, or even if you are, you may have never heard of it or even understand why this little, rather short war plays a big role in the Reformation. Joining us to answer that question and explain what it was all about, Dr. Martin Noland. He's a regular guest, past director of the Concordia Historical Institute and pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Marty, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Why is this little short war worth remembering today?
There's three things that I think are worth remembering about this. The Small Caldic War is really the first of the Catholic-Protestant religious wars. So they start in that year 1546 and are really only concluded in the Peace of Westphalia in 1648. So we're looking at 100 years, you could almost call it 100 years war of Catholics and Protestants against each other. So this is the first of many. This was the first real test of Luther's political ideas, that is, putting his political ideas into practice. And we can see how the Lutheran princes and the pastors and the laymen, how they put his ideas into practice in war, in politics, and in resistance to religious persecution. And finally, we see sterling examples of a confession of faith in the midst of persecution and suffering. So we see confession here not merely as, oh, I'm signing on to a document, but hey, you know, I might lose my properties, my house, my dog, my cat, my cows, my wife, even my life. And the words of the Mighty Fortress come to mind as we say those things. So in many ways, it is the first time after Luther's death in which we see Lutherans standing up to the plate and hitting the ball out of the ballpark.
So let's set the context. You mentioned Luther's death. What has occurred so far? We're about midway point between what is usually known as the period of the Reformation, from 1517 to 1580, thereabouts. But what has happened already in the Reformation by 1546 on the eve of the Small Caldic War?
The formation of the Small Caldic League in 1531, which is shortly after the Augsburg Confession was written, is the prelude to all of this. The League was established originally by Philip, the Landgrave of Hesse, and John Frederick I, the Elector of Saxony. Those were the two most powerful Protestant rulers at the time. And they saw this, they were politically, they were not naive. They knew that what they were doing was going to get them in trouble with the emperor. And so they set this up as a defensive league in order to support their religious practice. And then as this got out among the northern Europeans, these are the states that signed on to the Small Caldic League: Anhalt, Württemberg, Pomerania, Free Imperial Cities of Augsburg, Frankfurt am Main, Kempten, Denmark in 1538, Brandenburg, the electoral of Palatinate, which is where Heidelberg is, and, you might be surprised, France even joined in for a while about 1535, but later had to pull out. So you had this defensive league knowing what the emperor, and particularly the pope, had in mind to protect their estates, to protect the religion that they had already subscribed to at the Augsburg Confession. And so that was kind of set up, and as the emperor got news of the Small Colleague League and its various negotiations, which included, for example, agreeing that the members of the league would provide 10,000 infantry and 2,000 cavalry. That's not a small force. And sometimes they had larger numbers when they were opposing the imperial forces. He knew that he was up against something, and he didn't want to lose a good portion of the Holy Roman Empire to this group. So he began making plans as soon as he found out about it. And Luther also contributed to this before his death with what's known as the Small Cult Articles. He was asked to bring forward a confession of faith, which we know as the Small Cult Articles today. Well, the princes didn't quite like that. They accepted instead Melanchthon's treatise, which just dealt with the political issues at hand. And so that's all the preface to the beginning of the war.
Now, the Emperor Charles V, his interest in this, I take it, is not solely religious. In fact, is it fair to say that other than how it impacted his political concerns, the religious issues here were not of such great concern to him, as was the fact that he had these northern princes in his empire essentially preparing themselves to meet him in battle?
Well, that's been debated, and depending on what you read in the histories, they may take Charles' side or they may take the Small Colleague side on this. Is, you know, you read histories of the Civil War, and you'll find some authors that really side with the Confederates. It's the same thing with the histories. Officially, Charles, in July of 1546, he outlawed John Frederick, the Elector, and Philip of Hesse for these reasons. For Philip's bigamy, that is, that he had a second wife, while he had the first one, you know. Second, that John Frederick had seized the bishopric of Naumburg-Zeitz, that they'd both attacked Württemberg, which is in the south of Germany, and they'd seized Brunswick in 1545, and the last one would have been the most proximate cause. So that is officially what he told people. This is why I'm going to war with the Small Colleague League, because of these, you know, these various offenses. But we also have letters that Charles V wrote to, I forgot who it was, I think it was his sister, in which he says, I'm really doing this to reclaim the Catholic faith. So if you take it in his public statements, you'd say, well, he's just doing what he needed to do from an imperial standpoint. But if you take it on what he's telling his closest confidant, that is his own sister, Charles V was really intending to purge the Protestants from the world.
So his intent, while it may not have been at the beginning of the Reformation, his intent now is he views Protestantism, in particular the Lutheran Confession, as sufficiently dangerous to the empire that he's willing to go to war to wipe it out.
Right, and I think maybe, as you said in the beginning, even up to the Augsburg Confession, he thought that he could work around this and maybe find a diplomatic solution, because he didn't really want a civil war, which is what this is. This is what we're talking about, a civil war within the Holy Roman Empire. But as he got farther and farther along, I think he realized that there would be no way of keeping the Lutheran faith and also keeping the Pope happy at the same time. And he realized that if he did not keep the Pope happy, he could suffer the same fate that many of the other imperial, the German emperors had suffered, as that they were kicked out of office. I mean, the emperor was kicked out of office by the Pope, and the next guy, who was not even related to him, was given the imperial crown. So that's always a concern of Charles. And I think he begins to realize, as this war starts, that there really is, for him, no other solution. For him and his dynasty, if they're going to maintain the imperial crown, they've got to go after the Lutherans and the Protestants and get rid of them. And that's the only way that the Habsburgs would survive.
With about a minute here, we do need to realize, don't we, that Charles V, regardless of his personal feelings on the issue, which appear to be kind of spread out a little bit over the map, he, as the emperor, does have or was considered to have the responsibility to protect the Christian faith.
That is correct, yeah. So he's doing his duty.
When we come back, more with Dr. Martin Nolan. On this day, back in 1546, the small Caldic War began. We'll talk a little bit about the war itself, who, well, fired the first shot, so to speak, and how it was resolved. And yet, as we've already heard, not resolved. More war followed. All of that when we come back on this Tuesday afternoon, July the 15th. Would you like to learn about the Reformation theology you hear on Issues, etc.? We'll send you a pamphlet of Luther's Small Catechism for free. It contains the biblical teachings on the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and confession and absolution. Order your free copy of Luther's Small Catechism today. Just send your name and mailing address to talkback@issuesetc.org.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe that traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The Gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the Church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the Gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
You know that when your eyes close here, that when they open there, the first face you'll see, like the blind man, is Jesus's.
Pastor Chris Roseborough, host of Fighting for the Faith, speaking at this year's Issues, Etc. Making the Case conference.
This is the gospel. It's Jesus. And when you take these texts and make them about you, you miss him. And you leave yourself with no hope. And our hope is in him.
You can listen to Chris's entire presentation and teachings by Craig Parton, Matt Harrison, Al Schmidt, Will Whedon, and Jonathan Fisk on a new audio DVD for the 2014 Making the Case Conference. We'll send it to you for a donation of $300 to Issues, Etc. before Labor Day. For more information, look for the DVD logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Martin Noland is our guest, past director of the Concordia Historical Institute and pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. We're talking about the Small Caldic War, a little war, a short war that began on this day in 1546 in the middle of the Lutheran Reformation and led to some more war, actually some much bigger wars between the emperor and the forces of the Reformation. Now, one of the things we got to sort out before we get into the war itself is this idea of going to war over religious confessions per se. They have their political aspects, but that's a little foreign to us today, with the exception, of course, of Islam, the idea of going to war because of different religious confessions, an idea not at all foreign to men of the Reformation era. Why was that?
Well, they still had a medieval outlook on this. Because this is the end of what we call the Middle Ages. The notion that it is wrong to go to war purely for religious purposes is really a result of the subsequent 100 Years' War with the Protestants and the Catholics, and in many cases, brothers against brothers, just like a civil war in America. And after 100 years of that, the Europeans said, this doesn't make any sense. And some of the earliest rationalists, like Descartes, one of their big puzzles was, how can we form a civil society without going to war all the time over religious issues? So we are all, and certainly in the United States, we've learned a high degree of religious tolerance, probably the highest that's ever been seen in the world. But here in 1546 in Germany, it is the Holy Roman Empire, and being holy, it's all about your religion. This is why we are here, and part of the reason that the Pope gave the emperors of Germany so much power in the minds of their soldiers and the people is because the Pope wanted them to conduct crusades. Part of it was the crusades over in the Holy Land, but also then in Estonia and Latvia, that area of the Teutonic Knights, and against the Hungarians, and then later over in the New America. All of this was with the notion of that the cross has to advance. And so if that's challenged, well, then Christ is being defeated, and you just can't do that within the medieval mindset. So both sides really kind of have this idea, except Luther has different ideas, and that's where it gets put into practice. So the princes are still kind of, they're saying, we have to defend Lutheranism, and they're doing that right, and that's what Luther says too. But can you force somebody to believe something against their conscience? And that's something that Luther says no. So he's against the burning at the stake of heretics. He's against forcing people to come to your faith. It's a matter of the word, he says, not the sword. Words, not the sword. Don't mix your letters up when you do that. So this is beginning to see a change in that whole medieval outlook, even though the war itself is pretty much a religious war.
Who, so to speak, fired the first shot? I know that the emperor, as you mentioned before, already views certain acts of aggression on the part of the German princes, but how did the war itself begin?
After he had announced that John the Frederick was outlawed, he then gave the electoral title, which is very significant. I mean, it's the highest position within the empire, to Maurice of Saxony, which was the other group of Saxons. And then Charles V takes an army out of Austria, which is his home base, and goes into southern Germany, into lands where there are Protestants, and begins picking them off. And there really, in that area, there wasn't a lot of forces that had been developed. The small called group was primarily in the north. And so the folks down in the South Germany say, help, help us. And so John Frederick and Philip lead an army in the summer of 1546 and then into 1547 into the South Germany, and they start fighting down there. And then this becomes a problem, though, because Maurice has sided with the emperor, and then he, from his base in Saxony, begins attacking the other Saxony. So Ducal Saxony, well, now it's Electoral Saxony, is attacking the other Saxony, and John the Frederick and Philip have to come back up north in order to protect their homelands. And then this ends up in the Holy Week of 1547, where a much reduced force, they weren't ready for it. Charles V comes up with his imperial armies, crosses the Elbe River at Mühlberg, and defeats John Frederick and Philip of Hesse, and imprisons both of them. And it's signed into a charter, Wittenberg Capitulation of May 15th, 1547, and it looks like it is the end of Protestantism. John the Frederick is condemned to prison and eventually to death, although he wasn't ever killed. He actually got, that's another story, but his estates were given all over to Maurice of Saxony, and his lands were then withdrawn to a small area of Thuringia. Philip was also imprisoned, although he was the son-in-law of Charles V, so he got special treatment. And when they invaded Wittenberg, Katie and her kids left because they knew that the imperial armies were after them. And that's kind of the end of that short war, but it really continues on with continued pursuit of faithful Lutherans throughout the empire up until the Convention of Passau in 1552.
How close, we only got a few minutes here, but how close did the emperor come at least in this initial offensive and the ones that followed shortly thereafter, to effectively, at least in a political sense, if not in a kind of confession of faith sense, wiping out Lutheranism?
Well, there's two things. First off, when he came north, when Charles V with the imperial armies came north and captured John the Frederick, as I said, and were starting to the soldiers going throughout Germany, many people that were known as prominent Protestants left Germany, and they went to Holland and then to England. Martin Bucer, for example, who was a very prominent reformer, moved to England and was one of the starters of the Reformation in England. So we could say even if Charles had defeated Protestantism in Germany, it would have grown anyway in Holland and England, as it did. But the other thing is that if it had not been for Moritz of Saxony turning about face, and that was, in April 1552, I believe.
About 30 seconds here.
Yeah, then it probably would have been a done deal. But during the siege of Magdeburg, which went on for 13 months, a lot of the faithful Lutherans were holed up there, and they put on a big... Moritz was losing the public relations battle, and he finally turned toward the Lutherans and then defeated Charles V. So it was by the grace of God, we have to say, but also Charles V really overextended himself in the area of political... He didn't have that quite knowledge of the German people that Moritz of Saxony did. So that's the short story on it.
Dr. Martin Nolan is past director of the Concordia Historical Institute, and he's pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church at Evansville, Indiana. Marty, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
When we come back, it's Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. this Tuesday afternoon, July the 15th. A question persists about Islam. Now, Islam has... You could write Islam's history without kind of depending it upon Christianity, but that would be a difficult history to write. You could probably no more write that history if it were trying to ignore the influence of the Old Testament on Islam. Is Islam a Christian heresy? Is it, in fact, a heresy of Christianity that has taken on its own character apart from Christianity? I'm not asking whether or not it's a sect of Christianity or a different variation of the confession of Christianity, but is it, in fact, does it have its root in Christian heresy? Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will join us in Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. We'll answer that question. Then we'll talk about Ruth with Deaconess Elizabeth Allman and the First Crusade with Dr. Matt Phillips. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Did you know that during the month of July, you can receive 6 archbooks for children on the best love parables of Jesus for less than $10? Find out more about this 6-book series, The Best Loved Parables of Jesus, for children ages 5 through 9 at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The Best Loved Parables of Jesus, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July.
Ah, the sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.